This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for an evening of contemporary ballet, an exploration of the city's Irish connection, or an exhibit that takes the real estate mantra, location, 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 to new heights. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Former New York City Ballet superstar Wendy Whalen joins an elite ensemble of dancers as the New Orleans Ballet Association welcomes stars of American ballet. Hand-picked dancers from New York City Ballet and Houston Ballet who perform works by iconic dance makers. Joining me now by phone is New York City Ballet dancer Daniel Obrick, who will direct and perform with these world-class stars. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Just last month, contemporary ballerina Wendy Whalen bid farewell to a 30-year career with New York City Ballet, and now local audiences have an opportunity to see another performance by this superstar. What can we look forward to?
Well, specifically with Wendy Whalen's appearance, Wendy embodies pretty much the ballerina, the way her body is sculpted, but also the lines she's able to create with her body, her generosity, her warmth, and her artistry on stage. It's a rare find to see people who have this kind of quality. And probably what distinguishes her the most, it's what we call the aura of one of these ballerinas. You can't teach this. And when you're a younger student, you learn all the vocabulary and basics. But the gravity and the magnetism that a performer has, that aura or charisma, is really innate. And I think that's one thing that really distinguishes Wendy from many other dancers. And I'm just so honored and thrilled that she's able to join us and also be able to dance for the New Orleans audience again.
I understand she will perform two works that were created especially for her?
Yes. The first piece was actually made for her in 2012. It's a piece called This Bitter Earth, and it's choreographed by Christopher Wheeldon. Actually, both pieces are choreographed by Christopher Wheeldon, but are slightly different moods, if you will. The first piece is by Max Richter and Dinah Washington, and when you hear a piece of music that has a vocal undertone or accompaniment, it's very interesting to see how a choreographer interacts or weaves that into their choreography. In contrast to the other piece, which is, of course, the iconic After the Rain, Pas de Deux, also choreographed on her by Christopher Wheeldon, it's music by Arvo Pärt. We have live music on stage for that, so you'll see piano and violin accompanying that. You know, it really kind of takes the mystery and those qualities that we talked about earlier with Wendy and really highlights them. In a weird way, the two embody two different characterizations, I think, of Wendy. One is her kind of being a caretaker of her partner in peace, and one as if it's a really mutual bond and relationship with her partner on stage. So it's kind of neat to be able to see the multiple facets of an artist in one show.
Who are some of the other iconic dance makers whose works will be performed?
We start with pieces by George Balanchine, of course, who is the founder and creator of New York City Ballet. Also pieces by Jerome Robbins, who is most famous for, of course, West Side Story, and also receiving some buzz nowadays with On the Town on Broadway, which actually came from the ballet Fancy Free. And then, of course, we're featuring works by Christopher Wheeldon, who is probably the most popular modern-day choreographer. And then we're also bringing work by Stanton Welch, who is the artistic director of Houston Ballet.
Now, you are wearing two hats, one as director, the other as performer. What signature work will you perform?
I will have the joy and honor of performing two pieces, which have sort of become trademark pieces, I guess, in my repertoire. The first is a piece called Tango. This is choreographed in 2008 by a choreographer named Servi Gallardo. Servi was a past teacher of mine, and he went into choreography, and we were kind of playing in the studio one day and put together this solo in about 45 minutes to music by Astor Piazzolla, and it's become a really wonderful addition to a program, especially because in the first half of the program there's a lot of pas de deux, so I kind of wanted to change it by having the solo then come in and then having live music come in, so there's something kind of constantly stimulating the audience, either visually or by what they're listening to, be it recorded music or live music. And then the last piece, of course, is Fancy Free. I always consider it a coup to be able to bring a piece like this. And the fact that the Jerome Robbins Foundation, who we work with, as well as the Balanchine Trust, allow me to have the honor of presenting a masterpiece like this is just a huge, huge blessing. And this particular role, I think I've danced for 10 years. The other two sailors in this cast are Mar Ramazar, who's also performed this ballet. He's a principal dancer at New York City Ballet for many years. And the third dancer is Connor Walsh, who's from Houston Ballet. So kind of going back to that kind of hybrid collaboration between these dancers from New York and Houston Ballet, I think it makes it very fresh and exciting. So even though the ballet was choreographed in 1944, it almost looks as if it was choreographed 2 years ago because of how fresh the piece is. And that's a testament to the masterpiece that it is, but also the dancers who really care about keeping that piece alive. So I'm excited because the show two different sides. One is just pure dance, and the other one is kind of a narrative. Fancy Free is our anchor piece, and it is choreographed by Jerome Robbins, and the music is Leonard Bernstein. It's all American. Basically, you know, three sailors who have a day of shore leave, and they're trying to meet as many women as possible. But even though those three sailors, there always happens to be two women. So one is always left out. So they compete so much to try to get the attention of the one girl, hopefully, that you can dance with or that they can have a drink with. And at the end of the story, they actually end up not getting any of them because they got in the way of each other. And so it has a little bit of comedy, but it has a wonderful narrative. It also has virtuoso dancing and, of course, the great music of Leonard Bernstein. So I think if we get it right, the audience will go, we could definitely see this again. And I never knew ballet or dance could be like this. That's what we're aiming for.
Director and dancer Daniel Obrick, thanks.
Thank you so much.
The New Orleans Ballet Association welcomes Stars of American Ballet Friday, 8 p.m. at the Mahalia Jackson Theater. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. New Orleans is known for many things. Food and jazz immediately come to mind. But contributions of the Irish to our community, not so much. That's about to change in a big way as the New Orleans International Irish Famine Commemoration will highlight Irish history, culture, and community, bringing to life the New Orleans-Ireland connection. Joining me now are Irish Network of New Orleans President Adrian Darcy and Terry Landry, Special Projects Coordinator with the Irish Cultural Museum of New Orleans. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane. Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
How did New Orleans become a destination city for the Irish?
During famine times, basically from 1845 up until about 1851, over a million people left Ireland. Some would estimate about 1.5 million people left Ireland to get away from the famine and the starvation that was occurring over there. Of course, the major destination was the United States, and people are very familiar with the amount of Irish that went to Boston and New York. But what they may not be so familiar with is the amount of people that came to New Orleans. New Orleans at the time was a thriving city. The cotton trade was thriving, and a lot of empty cotton ships coming back from England and Ireland got filled with Irish immigrants. They came to New Orleans because, one, it was the cheapest ticket, and two, because of the thriving economy here, and word got back that there were jobs to be had. So thousands upon thousands of Irish people immigrated here. The immigration, unlike the cities in the north, in Boston and New York, the immigration stopped after the Civil War because the economy took a downward slope. But the Irish stayed, their descendants stayed, and they've had a great influence on New Orleans, on the culture, on politics, on music, on food, and their influence still exists today.
Now, this is a relatively new commemoration. I believe it began in 2009, just 5 years ago. How was the city of New Orleans chosen to host the famine commemoration?
It was almost kind of like an Olympic city search. Different members were asked to consider what we would have as a commemoration if it were to come to the city. We put together independent lists, and those were then presented to the Irish government. I don't really know what other cities were being considered, but I believe there were others. And in October of 2013, we received the notice that we actually were named as the host city for this year, which is a tremendous once-in-a-lifetime honor. The history here is very rich. The links between New Orleans and Ireland actually predate the famine. Going back to the 1700s, we know from records that exist in the Archdiocese that there were priests here even during the Spanish colonial times named Juan Brady, you know, and you see these names in the records. And, of course, Alexander O'Reilly, who established the Cabildo, was an Irishman. And they came here for opportunity even before the Louisiana Purchase and then during the famine years. But also they came here because of the Catholicism.
What are some of the major contributions of the Irish to our city?
They really transformed the Catholic Church. They reinvigorated it. You know, at the time, there was just St. Louis Cathedral and St. Patrick's. When you see when the famine Irish come here, you get see church after church being built in this kind of golden era of churches going upriver. These magnificent structures that still exist, St. Joseph's on Tulane, St. Alphonsus, which is a cultural center now,
Something that a lot of New Orleanians don't know is that our famed architect, James Gallier, actually was born James Gallagher and was from the County Louth in Ireland. And he got educated, I believe, in France. He was a fluent French speaker. When he finally immigrated to New Orleans, he changed his name to blend in with the French aristocracy that were controlling New Orleans at the time. And many of his great buildings, including Gallier Hall itself, still stand today.
One person we can never forget, too, is Margaret Fahey. Her statue was the first public statue dedicated to a woman in the United States. And that statue still sits in the St. Teresa Church area. She was a philanthropist and an entrepreneur, an Irish immigrant who suffered tremendous loss, but yet managed to go from being a laundress at the St. Charles Hotel to a businesswoman. But she never forgot her roots. She gave money and bread to the poor, milk to the children in the orphans' asylums, and she really embodies the spirit of entrepreneurship and generosity.
Indeed. The Irish courts also had a great influence and continue to this day on Louisiana judiciary, in the legal system, and in politics. Actually, from about 1870 to just before World War II, nearly every New Orleans mayor can trace their ancestry back to the Irish, and most of them can trace their ancestry back to famine immigrants. To this day, you know, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals Chief Judge McKay, family originally came from Ireland. There's always been a very strong Irish presence in government and politics in New Orleans.
So how are you paying tribute to those who made this city their home during the Irish famine of the mid-1800s?
Through a series of activities, we've managed to convey the whole picture. At the Irish Cultural Museum, which I'm a part of, we have built and are opening a brand new exhibit on the Great Hunger on Gata Mór. It consists of an exploration and a discussion of the famine and the reasons why and the reaction by the British. It's just a very comprehensive look at the famine. And then we also take it over to New Orleans and we look at what happened when they got here. And that's really new ground. There's been very little work done on that. So we're very proud of it. And there's a video with scholars that also is a companion to the exhibit.
There's lots of events that are doing a balancing act between commemorating a million people that died and also celebrating the influence that the Irish had because of that tragedy on the city of New Orleans. The symposium, which is being sponsored by Tulane, but it's actually being held at St. Alfonso's Church that Terry was talking about earlier, and being run by Dr. Laura Kelly, who is a historian and an expert in immigration especially. She has got together some great scholars from Ireland and England, this country. For instance, she has Caroline Cannerly from the Strokestown Famine Museum in Ireland coming out to make a presentation, along with Sean Tanner, who's coming down from Chicago, where he runs the Irish Famine Education Institute. Also, we have Richard Campanella, a renowned scholar, and he's talking about where was the Irish Channel. So his focus is completely on the New Orleans aspect regarding where the Irish immigrated when they came. Professor Terence Fitzmaurice from Tulane is also speaking, and he's talking about the Irish participation in the U.S. Civil War, which was huge. All these lectures are free and open to the public. And there's going to be Kira Brachnach. She's coming over from Ireland, displaying her photographs about Ireland post-famine, just to illustrate how the country looked at the time. And then we have Christine Keneally, who is one of the most renowned scholars internationally, talking about the relationship between the famine and the Choctaw Indians.
In recognition of this great event, on Friday night we have a parade. The St. Patrick's Marching Club was going to usher in an event that we're calling the Lace Curtain Night, and it's a benefit and a concert. It's going to benefit the Lantern Light Ministry, which is spearheaded by an Irish nun, and she feeds daily about 200 homeless and poor people in the mid-city area. And then we're going to have food from restaurants and music. The Poor Clares, a wonderful band, are reuniting that night. They'll also perform the next day at the Irish Fest. An Irish Fest, it's a dance competition. Registered dancers from all over the South are coming in for that. There's Gaelic football, music, Celtic canines, genealogy. There's a kids' tent. It's just going to be an amazing day.
And what happens Saturday night after the family festivals?
The Irish Network New Orleans is putting on its Black Tie Gallier Hall Family Commemoration Gala. We're doing it in Gallagher Hall because, of course, it really should be called Gallagher Hall. We have all the Irish dignitaries coming over there. We're preaching a story of one of the best Irish immigrant families in the city, the Brennans. The Brennans are all coming together, all the cousins, and they're providing great traditional Irish cuisine on the night. We also have great entertainment. We're flying down Tara O'Grady from New York. She gets these traditional Irish songs and puts a blues and a jazz flair on them. She's playing with Brian Seeger and some other local musicians. We also have Joni Mugavan's traditional Irish dancers will be there, along with McTaggart. Also, we're going to have Kiltis, which is a traditional Irish local group that plays the bower on the fiddle, the accordion, and they're going to be playing that music. Then we have Black 47, which is another great Celtic rock band. And Black 47, their name, of course, is named after the famine. The worst year of the famine was 1847, and in Ireland it got named Black 47. So it's going to be a dignified commemoration of the famine victims, but also a celebration of Irish New Orleans, and we're looking forward to a great night.
The city has an Irish heart. I really believe that.
I think now, finally, in the last few years, the Irish government has recognized the connection between Ireland and New Orleans. And of course, getting awarded this is a huge honor.
Adrian Darcy, president of the Irish Network of New Orleans, and Terry Landry, special projects coordinator with the Irish Cultural Museum of New Orleans. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Irish Famine commemoration events run Thursday through Sunday at venues across the city. For more information, check the website ifnola2014.org. Now, when it comes to real estate, locale reigns king. Rhino Contemporary Craft Gallery presents Location, 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 an exhibit of artwork about home, place, and architecture, which coincides with the National Association of Realtors Conference, opening this weekend. Joining me now is Rhino Gallery Director, Vitrice McMurray. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
So tell me, how did this project come about?
Well, every year we have in the fall a themed show where the members who are used to doing a wide range of wonderful pieces with fine craftsmanship actually do pieces on a theme. This year, with all the realtors coming to town, we thought we would do a show about home, place, and architecture. So we have a wonderful array of witty and ironic pieces done with fine craftsmanship and humor about home, place, and architecture. And a lot of it is about New Orleans, but a lot of it is about where we are in our souls and minds. New York, heaven, the ocean, favorite places in the universe, and just wherever we feel at home.
So how were the works selected for this exhibit?
Well, we encouraged all the members to make pieces, and most of the members did. And then we had select invitational outside artists, and we'll actually have some jurors that come in and actually pick the best in show, and we'll have a monetary prize. It's a really interesting assortment of pieces in wood and glass and clay and jewelry and mixed media.
So let's talk about the artists involved in the show. Who are they, and how do they explore the subject of real estate? What topics do they examine?
Well, for instance, our newest member is Peggy Bishop, who's a wonderful artist that makes those wonderful ceramic totems that you might see along Bayou St. John. I don't know if you've noticed
those,
but they're pretty amazing. She just joined us a few months ago, and she did a 6-foot-tall ceramic totem on the idea of the planets. Because recently Pluto was retired as a planet.
Uh-huh.
So she did this totem with about 8 different pieces of ceramics denoting the planets, with Pluto being a good place to retire. And then Peg Martinez, who's a woodworker who does meticulously crafted cabinets with little drawers and very, very precise woodwork, did a leaning drawer cabinet called Property Lean. And then another woodworker we have, Michael Boyle, made a huge turned wood bowl, and then on the outside he carved scenes of New Orleans in the actual wood all around the outside of the bowl. It's really quite something.
Sounds like it was a lot of fun also.
Well, it is fun. Our openings are fun and our work can be really fun, especially when the artists really focus on a certain theme.
Do you have a piece in the show?
I'm a jeweler and I have two pieces in the show that are both cloisonné enamel scenes, and one of them is a scene of one of my favorite spots in the universe, the Morning Call Arch in the City Park coffee shop. And I surrounded that with silver and added a peridot stone, and I took a French Market coffee can and flattened it and cut out part of the coffee can and riveted that. Anyway, it's one of those modern pieces that combines a lot of elements. And my other piece was actually inspired by the Ralston Crawford photography exhibit at NOMA a couple of years ago. I was doing a demonstration and lecture at NOMA, and they gave me the gallery book of Ralston Crawford, who did this wonderful black and white photographs of New Orleans in the 50s. And there was a great doc scene there. And I've always loved the kind of on the waterfront, raw, black and white feel of the docks in New Orleans. So I did a cloisonné scene of the docks in New Orleans and did a lot of silver around it with an amethyst stone. So my pieces are both about New Orleans. And a lot of the pieces in the show are about different aspects of the city that people really hold dear.
Yeah, there's no place like home.
I know.
Tell us a little about Rhino Contemporary Craft Gallery. You've been located at the shops at Canal Place for a few years now.
We have a beautiful space right in the middle of the second floor. And right now we have 27 members and our business is growing.
Now, Rhino is a cooperative gallery?
It's a cooperative, which means that all the members work 3 full days in the gallery, and usually everyone is on at least 2 committees because we do everything, as I say, from the accounting to the mopping and everything in between.
How are you hoping that this exhibit will make a lasting memory of our city's neighborhoods, homes, and estates?
Well, I think it will remind people of a lot of subtle and wonderful things about our city because each artist sees it in a different way.
Patrice McMurray, director of Rhino Contemporary Craft Gallery. Thanks.
Thank you.
Rhino presents Location, Location, Location with an opening reception at the gallery on the second level of the shops at Canal Place. Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.